Yeah, I've come to learn. Others say I'm the national husband, others say husband the country, others say the country's husband. Yeah, I've heard those. I don't think I should call them praises, but labels. Yeah. Some of the things that are described in the Bible as characteristics of love are not the yardstick that we use. We fall short on forgiving each other. We fall short on affording each other respect. Respect is accorded to what do you have? What car do you drive? What title do you hold at work? What's the level of your education? It's very few relationships, whether it's platonic or whether it's, you know, sexual relations, where we genuinely like each other for either our mindset or our kindness or our humility.
Mr. Lovalo, hey. Some burning questions. Mr. Lovalo, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. I am very excited to have you here and honored. I know you're a busy man, and I am honored that you made time to be with me. How are you feeling today? How are you? What has been going on?
I'm okay. I'm good. Yeah. I think I'm at peace. A lot has been going on. We've been launching my recent book, Falling in Love with an It Girl.
Yeah.
And I think we've done 3 launches so far. And we've done Cape Town, we've done Joburg, and I've done a homecoming in Ekurhuleni, because I'm from Ekurhuleni. So I went to Carnival City. And it's been quite a lot, actually. Just experiencing the launch, trying to conclude the book before that, finishing off shooting maths and traveling in between. But I think I'm at peace. It's been a long one and it's been tiring, but I think watching everything outplay itself, I think I'm easy. And I think more than anything, I just want to, bask in the success of having to launch a second book.
Nice.
And not even think about whether there's numbers coming or not, but just having to successfully close the project and here's the book. So I think that's what makes me happy and at peace. Yeah.
I like the fact that you're saying you're at peace. I mean, that's priceless.
Yeah.
Now, you an author, right?
Aspiring.
You are.
Aspiring.
you are an author, right? You are a speaker. You are an entrepreneur. You are a foundation founder. And now recently you are a reality star. Am I missing anything else?
There's a lot, but I think those would encapsulate who I am. I'm a father as well.
Oh, yes.
So I think probably I'll just highlight that one, that I am a father.
Wow. So now, but before everything that I have mentioned, who was Bongani?
Who is Bongani? I think I would plainly say, one, I'm my mother's son, and 2, I'm a guy from Guatemala who just loves life and who thinks life deserves to be lived. And in whatever possible way I can live life, I try and give it my best. I'm just a guy who wants to go and explore, because I think life is about, you know, experimenting it. It's about living it. Yes, of course, there'll be mistakes, faults, but also there'll be good moments. So I think life just needs to be lived, and I'm just out there to live the life.
True.
Yeah.
So now, without going any further, congratulations on your second book launch, Inhliziyo Mkhohlisi. You know, now a lot of people are curious here, right? Was this book inspired by someone you met on the show?
No, I think as human beings, we always want to be in charge of telling of the story. And because people have met me in their big numbers from the show perspective, they would think the book has got to do with the show. I remember as well when I was releasing the first book, I just buried my biological father. And I remember I had penned a letter and about how I felt about, you know, him and his death. And those people knew that I'm writing a book. They then assumed that the book is about him and his death and our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And only later on to learn that actually it's not about him, but my journey as a father and probably drawing lessons from his absenteeism in my life, but not necessarily about him. And people thought, so I tend to get, because I think every time I drop the book, there is something that's either happening or about to happen, you know? It just becomes an opportune moment. I had not planned that my father would die, but I was on the journey of trying to finish off the book. And because I've been teasing people along the journey, so they thought that the book, when I spoke about his death and attending his funeral, and then people thought, Yo, Bongani is writing about his father.
Oh,
we want to hear it. So the book is not anything to do with Married at First Sight or the person that I'm married to on Married at First Sight. Yeah.
No, that's clarified. That's clarified.
Yeah.
Now on the book Nhliziyo Ngumkhohlisi, the character Mkhoseli, right? I wanna know, did you draw from your personal experience or was it people that you know that inspired? What inspired the book?
What inspired the book? First, Mkhoseli, there are traces of me in Mkhoseli, but I've borrowed from pieces of probably my friends, people I know, but also probably the conversations from society of what they expect a man to be, what a man must be. Daughter must, princess, these days we call it princesses, all of these things that society would want to define men as, I think I've borrowed from that. So probably 30-40% of Mkhoseli would be a Bongani. I think his taste on things would be me. And then her behavior and these other things I would have borrowed from other people. What inspired the book? Ideally, I thought I was going to write a book about love at the age of 40. I thought maybe I would have gathered enough experience on relationships and love, and then probably would be married and having a multiple or a couple of kids in the marriage, and I would sit and tell tales about, you know, the past that I've experienced. You know, take three or four relationships that I think had an impact or were significant, and reflect on them. But so last year I was approached by one of the big five publishing companies in the country, and they asked me to write another book and write a book about manhood, fatherhood, and a boy child, and with the different thematic issues that they wanted us to address. And the model was more of me having conversations with men that have experienced those thematic issues. Top of my mind would be, what does grieving mean for a man? And I've had conversations with men who have either lost a child, lost a mother or a father, or lost a loved one, or actually lost a partner, and tried to understand, what does it mean when they talk about grieving? And I have a chapter I wrote, I think, that has got to do with an empty nest. All of us have got this idea that we are building the things that we're building for the comfort of our kids. But once they leave for university, half the time they're not going to come back. They'll just come and visit. So when you're now left with your wife or your partner in this empty nest, when you look at all of these things, then what does it say to you? You know, how do you feel about being left in this big house, this 3-bedroom, 4-bedroom, 5-bedroom? And so we've got different topics that we've tackled. I think I wrote about 4 chapters and I couldn't continue because it was such a emotionally involved book. Because I've got to talk to these men and then come back and interpret what they're saying to me. So I remember one time sitting in the study, I had quite a heavy heart, and I think I thought about a friend and his escapades on relationships, and I then found myself typing something about an encounter with him and his partner, And from that, I found myself actually reflecting on the book that I wanted to write. And I started plotting, actually. I was like, okay, let me plot. If this book was to arrive, where will I start it and go? Mm. And as I was plotting it, I then had this fuzz, this excitement, you know. And that's how I started writing it. So after the plot, I was like, actually, Bongani, why don't you write this book? Leave this one. It's too heavy, emotional. Wow. It's such an emotional burden. And I remember I wrote the first chapter, the second chapter. So the first chapter of the plot became three chapters of this book, okay. You know. And I then realized that actually it's bringing some type of excitement because it's sort of like I'm reliving moments, you know, because I write the book on the backdrop of COVID. And it starts with 2020, us listening to the president telling us that we're closing down the country for 21 days. There's somebody who's tested positive for COVID. They're having to, you know, all of that thing. If anyone remembers the 21st or the 23rd of March, 2020, what it meant, you know, the silence that followed after that conversation, what we then came back to know as family meetings. So I write the book from that backdrop, you know. So as I was going through it, I then had exciting moments because I know at some point in time we sneaked into the township for parties because many things in, you know, in the suburban areas were closed. People were following the law.
Yeah, exposing us now.
Because those are the things that unfortunately in us trying to escape being, you know, depressed or anxious, we drove to townships. We drove, my parents didn't want me at home. Like, we are Zula and so on. So don't come here, you know. If you come here, then you're going to stay for the duration because we can't have you in and out, you know, which is some of the things I use in building the story, of Mkhuseli's parents having to be saying no one moves willy-nilly in the house. We've got a quarantine area and so on. So what gave a bit of, you know, emotional and psychological reflex or relaxation would be the things we ran to Elokshin, you know, some parties at some backyard, going to buy alcohol, somebody selling alcohol from their house, but you must call first before you get them. And then I was like, actually, we didn't have a moment to go back to COVID and reflect on the impact of COVID, bad and good, you know, and really triggered me and, it excited me as well. So I was like, actually, this is my happy pill. Let me actually explore it fully. So that's how the book came about. It became an escape from the real book that I had to write. So the other book is still going to come out. But this was just sheer coincidence of an escape.
That's inspiring. Now you mentioned something very deep, society. And we all know nowadays society often tells men to hide their pain, hide their weakness. Why is being emotionally honest important to you?
To free yourself. There's nothing that is more important than being free as an individual, whether it's a man or a woman. But unfortunately, men live in shackles, and then society is not ready to have that conversation. That the troubles we find ourselves in, whether it's men being instigators and perpetrators of violence and the disorder that we have in society, is because we've created this nest for them to thrive in this behavior, because it becomes an escape, you know? As and when we talk about these ills that men perpetrate, whether as things that are born in them or as an escape outlet, society is not saying, let's pause and actually attend to Talibo Bongani and say, what drives them there? You know? And I always make an example to say, how many radio stations have a segment that deals with men issues. You're only going to have a conversation about men, manhood, and not even just men and manhood, how problematic men are and how much men are perpetrators of violence. Around 16 days of activism. By sheer coincidence, when it comes to Movember, men's mental health, and it's just a passage, you know. While society basks in Mother's Day, Women's Day, Breast Cancer Day, 16 days of activism, you know, just in August, pause and watch how much companies spend on celebrating women. I'm not saying we mustn't.
Yeah.
But if I'm having a conversation with myself about what makes my car to stop along the way in a journey that I want to take, then which means the money I have, I must spend it in resolving the problem that makes this car not to arrive where it wants to go. But as society, we continuously think that by God's grace, the problems that men are going to be resolved by the Holy Spirit. Without us having to say, let's sit, let's attend to these issues. What makes Bongani to behave like this? Because while we might want to think that men or society is dismissive when somebody starts a conversation that says men are generally violent, not only to women and kids, but amongst themselves.
It's true.
Get to a space where men are sitting as a group and one disrespects the other. What is our first resolve? Come outside, let's fight. You know? Because we're taught that we've got to defend our integrity and honor as men. But also amongst men, but also when a woman speaks, and I'm not saying all of these things that they are correct, but I'm saying it's wired, it's in the DNA of society. Yeah. And we then have to say, how do we reverse these things? So your company having to spend 200,000 rands in August for two or three events and only spend 28,000 rands in November just to gather men for 2 hours for a small conversation that is rushed, you are not doing justice to the problem that we are having. Because that problem exists. We can't wish it away. We can't pretend it's not there. The more we pretend, the more it grows. When people want to reflect on the statistics of violence around 16 days of activism, they must start the conversation with the whole violence question. How many men are reported dead because they were killed by another man? How many men got into a fight and stabbed each other and they're being treated in hospital? So men are not just only violent to women and kids. We just have a violent nature of resolving issues. So our first response to conflict is violence. Am I saying that we're not doing it to women? No, I'm saying we are doing it and it's appalling. But it's not just a target that we woke up in the morning and said, we're going to face our charge on women and kids. It is our general reflection of how do we resolve issues. So which means we've got to pause and say, how do we make men have a reflection on how they resolve issues? Then secondarily, it would be you can't act and behave in this fashion towards women and kids because they've got to be protected. But I don't think we've got to be living our life trying to teach men how to treat women and children. But we've got to be saying this is how a human being is not supposed to behave without having to associate a sex. Because my respect as a human being should be respecting Peter as a human being, not because of your man.
True.
And I should be able to respect a child, not because of their child, but because they are a human being and everyone has got a right to live. So we are quite reactionary in addressing these issues. And unfortunately, until we have the realization that no one is coming to save us but ourselves, we're not going to win this battle.
That is so true. I think we only have ourselves to save ourselves. And in this case, it's the societies that we live in. Because I agree with you with what you're saying, because you see it a lot. Like when you talk about, let me just say violence, right? Or gender-based violence. Gender-based violence is not only happening to women, but there are women that abuses men, and not only just verbally, but also physically. But you will see it a lot. Men are discouraged to even report such cases because it's like, I'm not going to be deemed as a man. Mm-hmm. And what deems you as a man now is the society again that we reside in.
Sure.
So that's kind of a bit discouraging. So I do agree. And we only have ourselves mm-hmm. to save ourselves. Now, in your first book, A Father, A Stranger, right? Father's story is there. They detail how their relationship with their fathers influenced them in who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to ask something. I know you mentioned to me that you lost your father. But how has your relationship with your father, like, molded the man that you are or influenced you in your journey?
I think I would always have two men or two father figures I would always reflect about. One is my biological father, and the second one would be my stepfather, whom okay. I always refer as my dad.
Okay.
And with my father, I don't have much to account for as far as the relationship is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why when I started, I said, I'm my mother's son. Because I've been raised in this feminine and matriarchal community where it was my mother, her mother, her sisters.
Mm.
But I would have experienced a father figure at church, at school, an uncle down the street who is a neighbor. My first encounter of a stadium was watching Sundowns and Kaizer Chiefs on Iwisa Spectacular.
Mm.
And it was the neighbor who wow. said, let me go with Bongani. So it was his son, and I was older than his son. He said, let me take them there. And my mother used to be is still a Kaizer Chiefs fan. So how I got associated with Sundowns, I took a tactical decision because the men support. Don't allow politics of soccer. So he was a Sundowns supporter, and the son was a Pirates supporter, and the mother.
Mm.
So I think I've been calculating probably from a young age, because after that game, I then resolved on supporting Sundowns.
Mm.
And not because of I'm a soccer person. I've really never been a soccer person until today. I still support Sundowns. But if you can ask me their last game, I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
But because he took me to the stadium, I resolved on supporting Sundowns so that he's got an ally that he can take to soccer matches, even if they're not playing with Pirates, you know. So the son can remain. I can go with him because I'm a Sundowns supporter, you know. So from my father's side, I only met the man when I was physically 20, if not 21.
Mm.
Yeah, 21, I think. That's the first time I saw him on my face. And probably I would have had the first conversation with him when I was doing grade 6, if I'm not mistaken, 5 or 6. And I remember I had to go and call him and ask for him to help with a blazer, because my mother had just lost her job, but she insisted on me staying in a private school. And he says, no, but I think let's see if your father can help you. Here's money, go to there used to be containers, Vodacom sales.
Yeah,
so I went to a telco, Vodacom container. I remember I went in there. It was the first time I spoke to him on the phone. And I called him, I was like, hey, I'm this person, my name is Bongani, your son, and I'm reaching out for help. Winter is coming, my jersey is worn out, and the blazer. If you can help with either two or one of them, would be a great deal. And the man said, unfortunately, right now, there's nothing I can help you with. If something comes out, I'll actually reach out. But then he doesn't ask me, how will I reach you? And I remember that it was a very quick conversation, man. If that conversation would have lasted more than 48 seconds, I don't know what was happening. Because I remember, I think it was 2 rands that I used to call, and I still had change. So that was my first conversation with him, grade 5, grade 6, and then I then meet him when I'm 20, 21, somewhere there. But we never get to have a good relationship. You know, when you say, in tambo paraffin, I think a paraffin, it just couldn't catch, you know, irrespective of how much we tried. And then one had to face the realities that this is not holding water, you know. But my mother also gets married the second time to this gentleman, who becomes a dad. And this is probably the only encounter I have, close to a father. And, I think it should have been my early days of tertiary, probably around 18, 19. They dated for a short time, then they got married. And, I always say to people that I don't remember the man, having to argue with my mother and then throw an insult about how he's taking care of her kids. Because he found my mother with kids, you know? And, so for me, that's the closest I have of experiencing a father. And I think we're more of younger brother, big brother, because he never tried to interfere on or try and say, let me unteach you this and that. You know, he came in when it's necessary. And he always said, you are the one who's going to live this life. So when you've got questions, come and ask it. Let me give you a perspective and you decide on your own what you want to do from there, you know. But he was there. He was there to teach you about life, support you at school. And so it's only from him that I can draw lessons of at least what a father could be. And probably on the other side, it would be me taking from the absence of a father, to say, I wish my dad was there. I played tennis when I grew up. And I always say to people that, I'll never come to a speaking engagement and say, I'm from the dusty streets of, because the township I come from, we never had dusty streets. And opposite Ekaya, there was a tennis court.
That's fine.
Yeah. So I'll never try and claim, you know, what becomes, you know, that card of many speakers when they get to a place. In the days, I wish he was there. To come and cheer, to come and support, you know. And I could only borrow from his absence and what I wish he could have been, you know. And also take from Babaga Ayanda, who is the neighbor who took me to the stadium. And also probably take from my history and English teacher, Wabnogazi, on what he then became to me as far as a father who supports you through education, you know. And probably take from Reverend Majola, who was the priest at my church. And when I'm absent, he would come and stop his car at home and say, ah, guess I'm waiting for you. Let's go to church, you know. So how I am today as a father is because I know the pain of an absent father. And I do not think there's a child who deserves to go through life wondering if, one, are they the reason that their parents are no longer together? But two, make it a reality by being absent to actually confirm that they are the problem, you know? But also through my journey as a father, I don't understand anyone who would want to skip the stage of being a father, because that's where you learn what love is in its purest form. When the Bible says God is love, as a man, you have an opportunity of actually having to learn and understand what love is when you look at your kids and you realize that there's nothing they can offer you, but you've got to show up and be something meaningful to them. You've got to make sure that they're fed. You've got to make sure that they're safe. You've got to make sure that they go to school. And right now here, there's nothing that they can do for you except to show you and teach you lessons that this is what love looks like. This is what patience look like. And they train you, actually. So for me now, retrospect, I'm like, how could my father have taken a decision? Because I do think it's a decision. Of course, there would be circumstances to others on why they would not be part of their kids. But I always say in the foundation that there's no excuse of you not being in your child's life. And I know it's a it's an unfair burden on men that they should fight. And it goes back to what we started on, that there's this continuous societal expectation that men must fight. So if you separate with Lerato, and because of your own conflict and the inability of having to sustain this relationship, either of you can decide to punish each other on either not having access to the child.
Why do you think people do that?
When a relationship gets to a level of desperation, trying to keep it, and the other one is trying so much to kick it, everyone wants to use anything that is within their reach, and we start by analyzing what is it that matters to you after this relationship. So if your mother is what is more important to you, when your partner or you, their mother or parent is the one that is more important to them before, after the child, you will then use their mother or their father, especially their mother, if it's a boy. So to you, they'll insult you because they know that your mother means dearly. And if she's got a father, and girls usually gravitate a lot to their fathers, and if you were to insult her with her father, you know that you would have pierced into the heart. So once you then have a child and they've learned that you, the next important thing to you is the child, or you learn that the most important thing to her is the child, you will then say to her, I'm not going to take care of this child if I'm not here. Because you are using whatever you can to bring her to her knees, so that you are then able to negotiate power of this relationship from your advantage. So human beings by nature, they are selfish. So at the time of conflict, you will always use anything that looks like a weapon so that we are at a stronger point. And both men and women do this. It's not something that is only done by men. And society will only want to tell us that it's men who do this thing. And I think through the work that I've done in the past 12 years, almost 13 years in the foundation, I can tell you now, kids are being weaponized by both men and women.
Very powerful. I don't know if you know, but now I know why you are being deemed or called or referred to as South Africa's national husband. Are you aware of that one?
Yeah, I've come to learn. Others say I'm the national husband. Others say husband a country. Others say the country's husband. Yeah, I've heard those. I don't think I should call them praises, but labels. Yeah.
Wow. With these kind of labels, what made you sign up to Married at First Sight?
Why did I sign up to Married at First Sight? Look, for me, it was more of, I do believe in the institution of family and marriage. And I've seen my dad love my mother for 17 years.
Wow.
And never have I had him in their fights, or at least their fights, maybe they were in the bedroom. I've never had him insult my mother, especially about her kids. But also I saw him love and protect my mother. And living in the 21st century, I think we grow to a place where we're influenced by social media and how we perceive love and relationships is on the lenses of Instagram and Facebook. Do we look, what's the word they use?
I might be behind, but I don't know, do I look on Flick or?
Yeah, are we on something Flick, like that? You know, are we something around like being picture friendly or something, or picture likable, you know? Are we, you know, when we are taking a picture, are we, you know, popping or something like that?
I get
But also we're a generation that wants the result without the work. Mm. And for me, I think, and I'm not immune to that as well. And I would go on a date, sit with someone, and probably I might be irritated by how they chew. Mm. And because my mind tells me that actually there's somebody around the corner who is better than this one, because this one chews badly. Then we're on a perpetual look for something that is better without having to sit here and say, how do we make this better? And I'm not immune to that, you know? So for me, I was like, probably let's change the style of hunting.
Okay.
You know? Let me leave it to somebody else.
Wow.
I'm a control freak, by the way. I'm a perfectionist, I think. So it took a lot for me to say, actually, let's allow somebody else to lead the process.
Wow.
But also, it was me saying, I'm not looking for love. Because I've fallen in love a number of times.
Mm.
And probably even my heart deceived me.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But probably now, let me look for somebody who is committed to the institution of marriage and building a family and exploring life with someone. Because some of the things that are described in the Bible as characteristics of love are not the yardstick that we use. We fall short on forgiving each other. We fall short on affording each other respect. Respect is accorded to what do you have? What car do you drive? What title do you hold at work? What's the level of your education? Actually, probably where, what is your family's standing in society for us to then respect you? And this is something that unfortunately does not only exist in women, but also even amongst men themselves. I don't know if you have said in the company of men where there's only two men that we can see, probably they are rich, and see how men fluff around them. We might want to come and say, no, women are gold diggers and so on. Come and watch men around a man that has got money. You know,
they become lapdogs in a way.
Yeah. You fluff around them, you know, you want to refill their glass, you know. So that tomorrow they can call you and say, where are we going to chill? Because they're going to pay the bill, you know? So that's how we go around in building relations. It's very few relationships, whether it's platonic or whether it's, you know, sexual relations, where we genuinely like each other for either our mindset or our kindness or our humility.
Wow.
So for me, it was more of these other things. I've looked at them and I've failed. I've looked for someone beautiful. And I found someone beautiful, like intimidatingly beautiful, you know, where you look at them and you're like, leave me alone, you know, or even you wake up in the morning and you're like,
I call on
you. It's me,
yeah,
you know, but in no time you fall flat on your face. One has used the yardstick of what does she have? What title does she have? And I've found women who've got serious titles, but still in the quest of that, I've fallen flat on my face. So until which point does, or do you say, okay, this is enough, let's try something different. And for me, MEFS became that opportunity to say, let me let everything out of my hands, let me trust somebody else. At least there's one thing I'm hopeful for, that this person is looking to build a family, is looking for marriage and building a family and living a life with whatever individual that is going to be given to her. You know? And then that's why I went to the show, to say, right now where I am, I don't think there's much of many things that we can still explore in the streets, but also I can't keep on proving a point, and neither can I continuously be asking women to audition to prove a point to me.
Wow. Now, I wanna ask you, based on what you just said now, right? What's your take on this? Because I hear it a lot, you know, even on the radio, you know, people call in and they would say, you know, it's important that you date, but in your bracket. So for lack of a better word, you know, what's your take on that? Because clearly going to the show, you are now overlooking all of that, right? You're like, I'm just here for love. So what's your take on what people say that, no, date someone on your level?
That's shallow. And I'm saying many of us have fallen to those realities where if your barometer has become the level of education, NQF level 7 or 9, you find a woman at a level, NQF level 7 or 9. Actually, she's renting an apartment. Actually, she's driving her own car. Sorry. And if your barometer is these three things, why have you failed in keeping those relations? If your barometer is that she must be a yellow bone or a dark chocolate, she must be tall, 1.9, model looking like body, she must be a Christian, speaking in tongues, your trajectory has taken you there.
Yeah.
And you still have fallen, you know? And I've continuously asked, and probably one day we should revisit the conversation of arranged marriages. Because in our relationship, outside of God, what becomes the higher power that we respect? Outside of God, who then becomes? Because God is the ceiling.
Yes.
After God, who then do we? Elohim says, Kota Milagui. Because in arranged marriages and marriages in the past, you would find that after God, the people we respect are our parents. And because they are the ones that would have initiated this union, we would not want to put our parents into disrepute. Actually, you marrying a girl was not you marrying them. It was you are taking them on behalf of your father because you are using your father's surname. And in the African context, we would never call you with your surname until your father is late. We'll always refer you as the son of. So even when you take somebody's daughter, whose name are you using? That's why then Zulus would say, "Ulethuma kuthi emagcekeni kababa." So whenever anything happens in this relationship, you would not want to put your father into disrepute. So it becomes that it's like inja as a chain in. The chain can only go up until a certain extent.
Yeah.
And when it gets there, you can try and push forward, but there's something that restrains you.
Pulls you back,
You know? And we've had rebels. And when you become that rebellious one, your wife then tells your mother, and your mother then tells your father, that Bita has become this kind of a human being. And your father would call you into a meeting with his brothers. And if you've got brothers, they will call your brothers as well. And if you are of an abusive nature and you're continuously in that behavior, they would then ask your brothers and say, if you've got Amandla, we Ntombazan, let's see if you've got Amandla, we Ndoda, because you're calling yourself a man. You know? So even after that session where you've been beaten in Xhosa, they will say, allow them to fight. Obetiwe ati buti komnye. So whoever gets beaten up or conquered must now bow to the one.
Yeah.
You know? So after that, you're cognizant that you ought to be respectful to your father and the voice of the man there. So whenever you look at your wife, you're not looking at your wife, but you're looking at her father. Because your father said to her father, allow her to come to our home and assist us to expand this family.
She's in good hands.
Yes. And it's your father's responsibility then to ensure that they create a safe environment for somebody else's daughter that they now perceive as their own daughter. But in the 21st century, Eurocentric or Western culture has taught us of individualism. My qualifications, my car, my money, my alcohol. We're not even patriotic because Western culture says you are an individual and you must live as an island. That's why not many of us would be keen on going back home Magnum Sabians or in December Magnum Christmas party because you don't think you're accountable to a community that you come from. And that's Western culture. So this individualism has made us to land at this chaos of how we relate with each other, whether it's friends, whether it's siblings, whether it's family, or the family that you're trying to build as an extension of where you come from. So that's why we should be able to have a conversation on arranged marriages, but not just only arranged marriages, but what becomes the authority. Because of some of us are even rebellious to our own parents. If your parents says, no, but you can't be behaving like this, Peter, you're like, but who are you to tell me?
I'm an adult.
I've got a bank account, I've got a house, I've got a car, I've got a girlfriend, I've got a wife, I've got a stream of girlfriends. So who are you to tell me? You know? Because in part of creating chaos in an African community, white people were quite intentional that we should not have them as a community, but tell them that they need to live as individuals. So for me, I thought I'm going to be tested to go beyond the norms of building a relationship, but find somebody who's committed to the institution of marriage, who's committed to the essence of family, but also somebody who understands culture, respect, love will come ultimately, because many of us didn't like certain things. I drink sparkling water. At the beginning of me drinking sparkling water, I never had an appreciation of sparkling water. But the more I could realize that sparkling water can make me babe, I grew fond of it because there's this outcome that comes from it. So you fall in love with a person because of their consistent behavior. And you're like, I love this. I love how Peter does things. I appreciate how Peter looks at things. I honor how Peter reflects about things. And you start having this warm fuzz. I'm like, actually.
Something.
But this business of butterflies, when I saw him, I didn't know whether to fall or to stand. You know, because what happens when that dies? Because many of us have left beautiful women, they've left handsome men, because the fuzz and the warmth died out. So what is it that when all else fails, so the day you lose your money and the bank come and repossess the car, the person who's going to leave you is the one that came here because of the assets you have. Not somebody who's going to say, hey, Peter, things are going bad. I think let's sell this German car so that the bank can have their money. And probably we can go and buy a TES downscale
and build up.
And then be able to re-navigate things. And probably we might arrive back at a German car. Because if they're not here for the materialistic things that we have. And that's why probably the language for both men and women always boils down to what she can get, what you are giving. But Peter, what is happening? But I don't know what she wants from me. I give her the money. Because outside of resources, we do not know and understand what is our role in building relationships. And outside of money being given, this provision, very few people talk about being emotionally secured, being cognizant that if anything was to happen, I know Peter will arrive at a snap of a finger. If there's a problem, Peter will sit and analyze and say, how best do we do it? And I trust his judgment. Actually, I'm looking forward to him telling me, how best can we navigate this? So that's why you'll find ways like Indoda must have a van, Indoda this. That's why people tell you about wife allowance, girlfriend allowance, because relationships have just become that, materialistic, shallow. That's why many relationships during COVID, many people divorced, many people broke, because outside of his pity that is happening, the up and down, waking up to work, going to the boys for a braai, going to the girls' night out and so on, we've never had a moment to actually sit and share thoughts about life. So those are the things that make us to be where we are. And for me, I thought, I'm not saying it's the ultimate answer, but something said to me, probably this could be a better moment to try something else, that you will not get to use your strength, You will not get to use your analysis, but you'll allow somebody to say, from the conversation I've had with you, this is what I think you could live with.
Wow. 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 I know you are a very self-aware person, but would you say that the show, on top of the knowledge that you have about love, would you say that the show added to that knowledge, taught you something about love, or it taught you something about yourself as a man?
Look, I think it re-emphasized the conversation that we don't want to have with each other on what is a relationship in the 21st century. Those who are Christians, they'll always say that no, Paul says it's not good for a man to live by himself. It probably, I think, applies for both men and women.
Mm.
But we've got this attitude that says we don't need each other.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm able to wake up in the morning and go to work, and month end they pay me a salary. I can buy warmth. I can buy a community of people I can rely on. And that's why probably many of us would pay a security company, a tracking company, an airtime or a cell phone network, you know, because we think that those are the things that make us who we are.
Mm-hmm.
So if I was to ask you, who are the five people you would call now to come to your house and have dinner with you? Or who would be the five people that can come and carry, not even your coffin, but can contribute? If they were to say that your accounts are locked up and
right,
we can't bury Peter, who amongst the people that you live with would say, we are here to pay for the burial of this man? You know? So for me, it re-emphasized that as a generation, I think we've missed a step on understanding what humanity is, but also on coexisting with people, whether it's platonic relations or, you know, marriage or sexual relations. And probably the show also reconfirmed and probably opened an eye that many of us go through this life wounded, and we don't want to take time to actually say, I am wounded. Let me take some time and attend to my wounds. And that's why many of us never get to achieve the things that we achieve, because we lose so much blood along the way. So for me, it has reconfirmed a number of things. One, that I love, and I still do believe in the institution of marriage, and I still do believe in a family. And when I say family, I'm not talking about my kids with my wife or partner, but her mother, her father, her uncle, her aunt, both on my side as well. But the people that we call dearly as our best friends, they are a family. So somebody who would think me and her and the two kids or three kids that we have is the only definition of family, then they do not understand life. And probably their school of thought is a Western culture, you know? So I am of the view that family extends beyond me and my wife and kids. And if any of us was to die, or both of us were to die, this is the same community we're going to rely on taking care of these kids, you know? So even how we raise them then should be cognizant that there is a community outside of the four walls that we stay in. I've asked one lady friend of mine, I said, if you were to die tomorrow, do you think your son could live with who? You know? So for me, it's reconfirmed that I love the idea of love and what family looks like and what family should be. But also, it has reconfirmed that how we perceive our participation in relationships is misconstrued. Because watching everyone else, because we become a community at Married at First Sight. So you have four couples, a community of 8 people. So you now become neighbors. So if you need salt, you must go next door and ask for salt. If you need wine, you must go, hey, Peter, do you have wine? Mm-hmm. Borrow me your wine. I'll replace it on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
So from there, you then get to observe on how we react to things and what we hold dear.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think many of us have an understanding that, unfortunately, there's no one who's going to work on this relationship except the two of you. So if you decide to abscond and think that the lady is the one that must play a role here, you're wrong.
Mm.
And if she's got the idea that hers is just to sit on the couch and raise her legs, you know, and rest them on a stool, and you'll have to do all of the work, unfortunately, she's misinformed.
Mm.
And I think as a generation, we all suffer from that. We're preoccupied with wanting to show up for what we think is more important.
Mm-hmm.
So you're a businessman, somebody else is employed. The same effort you put on waking up in the morning, being committed and intentional on, I must wake up, I must report for work, and look at the people that report for duty at me.
Mm-hmm.
So that this company can make profit and I'm able to pay them and I'm able to then enjoy the spoils of these profits. So every day you wake up with that mindset and you show up. And somebody who goes to work, who's employed somewhere and is told that they report for work at 8 o'clock, they know the consequences of arriving at 8:15.
Sure.
There's a warning. So even if you were to sleep drunk on a Sunday, you'd rather have babalas on a desk or in operating a machine.
But report, yeah.
But you're intentional that I've got to show up, you know? Whoever is focused on building their own academic ambitions, you are working, but you also want to do that degree, that honors or that master's. So you've got tests, you've got exams, you've got assignments. You're not going to pass all of them. There are some that you're going to fail.
Mm-hmm.
But in failing them, you don't give up and say, I'm done with this honors degree. You take your money and you reaffiliate for a module. You pay for the module and say, I want to rewrite it. And you come back and study so that you show up better in it. So the same intention and the same commitment, both in your academics and in your work, is not the same effort we want to put in relationships. We're thinking that somewhere the Holy Spirit will be the one that does the work, or somebody else's child must do the work while you become the prince or she becomes the princess. So who are you leaving this relationship to be guided by? And I think as this generation, somebody fooled us and said, you don't have to show up for it. It's the one, the relationship is the one that must actually work for you. And unfortunately, that's what keeps us failing in this thing, because I can water a pot plant alone. But it becomes easier and enjoyable when we both do it. And even be able to say, no, it's okay, Peter, today you don't have the strength, I'll do it. But I rest assured that tomorrow Peter has got it. So if I fall, he will carry it. But no one wants to reassure the other one. No one wants to show up. No one wants to be intentional. We just think it must just be a coincidence arena where I'm not sure this is a born, you know? So for me, it reemphasizes that we are living in a imaginative world. Probably we've watched too much of The Bold and the Bloody Fool. and we don't think that we need to show up. And unfortunately, a relationship needs you to show up and it needs you to be intentional.
Wow.
And I think from that experience, it's reconfirmed that as a generation, we continue to fumble in how we want to do things.
Wow. Well said. Well said. I have to ask you. You forgive me. I have to ask. You know, and this is another thing that I commended about you. You know, on the show, there were a few moments where comments about your physical appearance was mentioned, and you handled that with so much grace, which is very commendable. How does one deal with such critiques? And I'll say, angiboni mina into wrong. But for someone out there who's probably went through something like that, or, you know, people said such things about, how do you deal with such critique?
Look, I think in the context of the show, probably let's start here. Some of the things that you guys were hearing on diary sessions, we all heard them for the first time. And probably what trended as a video of me talking about six packs and gym and trust funds. Sorry. That was actually a response to the continuous assumption by either production or the community we were living in, because people wanted to make it a sensational issue. I would not have had her saying it the way she says it. But I knew and understood, because of the conversations we were having in the house, I knew that she knows that she said that I'm not her type. And equally, I've said you're not my type, because both of us, like, you arrive in that fast food, there's a menu, and they'll ask, do you want chicken or beef? Then you tick. Do you want a gluten-free or a brown bread or a white bread? So we all came with, you know, written ingredients of what would make this. So we knew and understood that neither of us sitting here are what we have asked for. But probably we'll take a gamble and say, why were we paired together? Is that one? But I learned that there was a narrative that people were trying to purport, you know, and probably because of they know what she has been saying in her diaries. So firstly, making reference to that response was because I was quite tired of people wanting me to feel the way they want me to feel about what they think is said and could be a reflection of me. Many a times we do the mistake of going through life looking for validation from wrong people or from people themselves. I've grown to know and understand that these are my shortcomings and these are my strengths. I know for a fact I'm a very handsome looking fellow.
Yeah, boy.
Actually, I look forward to spring and summer, as much as I don't like spring and summer. But I know that I've got proper beautiful legs because I've played tennis.
Mm-hmm.
So if I wear my shorts, it's not a toothpick.
Yeah.
I know my eyes. So someone says, oh, I've got beautiful eyes. I know. You know? So it's a question of you having to know and understand yourself and your shortcomings. But the most important one is not allowing people's failures or lack of a sense make you think that this is about you. People have got their own battles that they are fighting. And it's after you've had a conversation with yourself continuously that you learn that not everything is about me. If you were to shout at me now or use a swear word, it's not a reflection of who I am. It's insecurities that you are suffering from. And mine is to watch you dealing with these insecurities, you know, because you're trying to pull me to this space where I must also be uncertain about myself. I know for a fact I can't sing. So anyone who might want to put me in a choir, I'll tell them, you can't succeed because I know I can't sing.
True.
You know, somebody might say, well, let's chive in. I can't dance. I've got two left feet. I know for a fact. Yeah. What? And it's in me knowing that I can't feel bad when people are starting to dance there. You want to dance? Dance. I can't. But if you say, Bongana, a microphone, speak. I know how to speak. So gladly I'll jump into that. So it's being comfortable about your shortcomings. Know them. So that when somebody else wants to use them against,
it's nothing new.
I can't do that. Proceed. You know, I don't know or love how to bake. Mm. My daughter bakes. I cook. So if somebody was to say I must make them a red velvet or an Oreo or a whatever cake, I'll tell you a friend, you're asking a wrong person. We can call a friend of mine who's a pastry chef and we can have this thing delivered here.
Trump.
You choose, you know. So at times, as human beings, we tend to make things in life about us when they are not. And we should allow people who've got these problems to deal with their own problems.
Wow. Well,
and for me, I think I'm continuously, not that I've even put a finger in it, I'm continuously working on knowing and understanding my shortcomings and my strengths so that I don't have people having to define me and tell me what I am. Because when you don't know yourself, whether it be weaknesses, whether it be your strength, whether opportunities that lie there or what could be a threat to you, I know what is a threat to me. Abandonment issues, I have them. So whenever I walk into a relationship, I'm quite conscious and I calculate in the space what is what. And I then hope that we will not go and trigger that. And I look for things that must not trigger that. So before they get triggered, I must be able to have a conversation about that.
Wow.
You know, I know what, and you can never be perfect. We can fall short of those things, you know. But once you're in a continuous conversation with yourself, whether you find a coach, whether you find therapy, then you live in your own mind space. So that when you're then confronted by these things, they don't trigger your emotions. But they allow you to look at them and be like, no, this is not mine. Peter, deal with this thing. I'm coming back. I'm going to the bathroom.
Yeah.
You know? Then when you come back, you're like, nah, this has got nothing to do with me, Peter. Resolve it on your own.
Wow. Wow, that's well said. Now, you have been a strong voice on mental health, right? I know we touched base about this a little, but what do you think specifically men? Why do you think men in this day and age, they struggle to voice out their challenges or their difficulties? Why do you think men struggle to speak out in this day and age?
Could be two or three issues. One would be that society doesn't care. Actually, if you speak, we'll judge you. If you tell us you can't, we'll judge you. If you say to your family, I can't afford 1, 2, 3, they'll judge you. If you say to your girlfriend, I can't do this now, or I can't perform sexually at this level, she'll judge you. So the sad truth that society does not want to admit is that no one cares how the man feels. And the writing is on the wall. I made an example earlier on how much a company would spend on the mental well-being of women. But two, it would be that we have watched our grandfathers and fathers not speak. I used to enjoy going at my mother's home, which is in the Eastern Cape, when I was still growing up as a young boy. I used to spend a lot of time with old men. And I remember my mother's sister, my aunt, when I would visit, her husband had days where in the morning he would wake up, be prepared water, he would bath, he would eat his food, and he would take a jacket. And I would want to live with him. He says, no, not today. Because usually whether he's going to, you know, take the livestock into the field to go and graze, or it's him going to town and so on, he would allow me to go with him. So this particular time, he would not allow me to. And I'd be like, what's happening? He says, no. Sibiziwe singamadoda welale. So I'm going to gather his men and discuss issues that have got to do with the society that we stay in. So men's counsel and men's horo ya banna, what Sutus would call horo ya banna, has been something that has been embedded in the African community. Today we might speak about the men's conference. It's such a an artificial thing. But in the African community, men were called into a council of men.
Actually.
And they would leave whatever they need to do because of the chief has called all the men. And probably once a month at least that thing would happen, if not every second week. And they would come and discuss things that have got to do with the community that they live in. So whether somebody's livestock has been stolen and they found the person that has done it or they suspect Peter did it, it's going to be discussed there. Whether somebody decided to go and have an extra sexual relationship with somebody else's wife, it will be discussed there. Whether somebody decided to go and impregnate a girl without having married them, mm-hmm. that thing will be discussed there. Whether a family has lost their harvest and they can't feed themselves, it will be discussed there. And not only discussed so that we can make a pity party for Peter losing his harvest or somebody stealing somebody else's cattle, but it will be discussed because there must be a conclusion that comes and a solution that is applied for the problem. So those who would have transgressed, they would get punished. So whether you have beaten your wife and you are not listening, you have beaten somebody else's child, you've impregnated somebody's child without, marrying them, whether you have raped or, you know, punishment fit for you would be discussed amongst men.
Mm.
You know? And amongst men would come to a conclusion, what is befitting for Peter?
Mm.
And those would have lost livestock, would have lost your harvest, you're not able to feed a family. A family would not go hungry solely because their cattle has been stolen or because their harvest, you know, was spoiled or it was burnt and so on. That council must decide how Peter's family is going to be fed. So whoever has got potatoes, they must commit potatoes to Peter's family. Whoever has got pumpkin, they must commit that. Whoever has got maize, they must commit that, you know?
Mm.
Because there's no man who must go out of that council and go back home and feel inadequate. Because society does not care about any other shit. Sorry for using that word.
Yep, no.
But society cares on you being a provider and you being a securer.
Mm.
So when you come back home and your wife asks you a question and you say, I don't know, you're a failure in your manhood. So you can't leave that council and go home and be able to provide answers to your wife on how things must move going forward.
Mm.
So today it's made as if it's some glorious and profound thing, this thing of having to create spaces for men. It has been embedded in the African society. But once more, Western culture, Eurocentric, and this new civilization of individualism has taught us that we do not need to come to these communities
mm-hmm.
and be able to get in check with each other. So you would not be able to voice your concerns because of you do not spend your time in council with other men. So which knife is going to sharpen you? Because you don't spend time with knives.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have a coach. So whose wisdom do you borrow to apply solutions? You don't have a mentor, so who do you look up to?
Up to, yeah.
You have a father, but you don't respect him. Or an uncle who is a father figure. But because of their drunkards, they don't have a BTEC from, you know, a renowned university, you do not think they can tell you anything.
Now, there, would you say that's also the reason why you founded the Cool Dads Foundation?
Mostly, yes. Probably first, the pain of having to grow up with an absent father, but staying in a society where many of us, whenever we are head or fighting amongst the boys, no one has mm-hmm. that wiser boldness to say, I'm going to tell my dad.
Oh, wow.
Because when men or boys fight, if your strength is tested, there's a higher strength that you must be able to go and report to.
Mm.
So the ones I grew up with, very few said, I'm going to tell my father. So either you relied on yourself, myself, I ran home and fetched a table knife and came back and threatened to stab you if next time I'm going to Ilagabi. somebody else went to fetch their younger, their older brother or an uncle. Very few of us said confidently, I'm going to tell my father.
Wow. I see. Now, beautiful.
And today I would ask my daughter, she would listen, Dad, can I have one too? And like, but why are you asking me? Why aren't you asking your mother? And she'll say, I know you can do it. Kids deserve that confidence in their fathers. To know that when the world turns against them or challenges them, after God, there's another higher power that they can run to.
Yep. Yep.
You know? Mm-hmm. And as men, I think, and this generation, we've taken it so light. I always advise men that it's good to give your wife money, but at times, be the one that responds to these small things that your kids ask for. You know, I grew up going to my mother to ask for, you know, a pair of sneakers or soccer boots, and she would talk to my stepdad, and then she'll come back and say, we'll do it at this time. So whenever things went or I needed things, I didn't think of my stepdad. I thought of my mother, because my mind says the person who resolves problems is my mother. But half the time, women use the resources that they negotiate with their partners. You know, let's apply this resource here, let's apply that resource there. So as a man, you want to show up to your partner as a hero, somebody that can provide. But we miss the opportunity of saying, let me give my kids the same confidence that I can resolve things. Mm. When kids are fighting at school or debating something, and somebody says, no, my dad is going to buy me a bicycle. That's confidence. Because they've seen you do it. They've heard you saying, I'm going to do it. And you did it.
Wow. This really just shows me that being a father is more than just being present. It's beyond that. It is really beyond that. So now to men raising children in a society that tells them to toughen up, in a few words, what would you say to the guys out there?
There's no strength in toughness. Because anything that's tough, either it drags down to the end of the sea, or it will roll down. A stone, a rock, because of it's tough. But strength makes you realize the environment that you are in and then decide how you should apply you being steadfast on it. Or if you should be steadfast, because it's not everything that needs you to show up hard. I made an example one time of those who are Christians would understand when Moses led the Israelites out of Egypt and they were facing the Red Sea. And when they were looking at the Red Sea and they were looking back, there were chariots coming. They were insulting Moses to say, but why did we have to make us come and die here? And they said, let's turn and fight. Then Moses says to them, no, can't go and fight. I need to open the Red Sea. Because at times, we mistaken the power and the strength that we have. Because we must be able to distinguish. There is power to, there's strength to continue. And there's strength to fight. But sure. Many a times we take the strength and the power of continuing with life to fight. And by the time we conquer a battle, we don't have strength to move forward. And we die in the battlefield because the strength that we used was not to fight the enemy or whatever challenges we have, but it was for when they've exhausted themselves, then you are able to proceed. So at times we need to understand in life that it's not everything that needs you to fight. It's not everything that needs you to pay attention to it. At times you just have to watch it and say, devil play and I'll watch you. Once you're done, then I'll continue walking.
And how do you, I know you are a businessman yourself, right? How do you balance being a businessman, a foundation a founder, and being a father? How do you balance that and make sure that you succeed in all areas?
There'll never be a balance. One is going to suffer more than the other. And I had to make peace with which one must suffer at the expense of the other. I don't do an appointment that is going to make me absent at my daughter's concert. I don't care what happens. Even if the president was to call and say, at 4 o'clock, we need you in Mahlambandlovu. If I must pick up my daughter at 4 o'clock and take her to a ballet, that's where I'm going. Because she didn't ask for an opportunity to leave. I brought her here by God's grace. I can fumble money today, but I can still make money tomorrow. But kids do not interpret love with your monetary ability. How kids spell love, they say T-I-M-E, time. So the time you spend with them, it's not a money that you can use in McDonald's. It's not, no. You being here with them, you can take number of plastics and make a ball and kick it with them. And because you are here and you're doing this with them, that's what fills them with love, because our Father is here doing this. I know society teaches us, no, I'd rather cry in a Bentley than a queen. But believe you me, pain pierces the same way, irrespective of where you are. So with kids, the time you invest in them is what reassures them of the love that you have for them, not the things that you buy. I spoke to one of the millionaires in the country. I think he's ranked with the top 10 or top 20. I can't remember. And he says one of the things he wishes he could have done differently was choosing to take his kids to school every morning. And it's only now when they've grown up that he realizes that he made a biggest mistake. Because how they relate with him today, it's more at a professional level than at a father and a child. So they go to even an extent of calling, the son calls him sir. Because that's the level of engagement they have. The time that they've spent time is exchanging pens and ideas in the boardroom. So it's so formal. So for me, I arrived at a point where I said, in fatherhood, I can't be found wanting. You know, I said to my daughter, you must know that 70% of the time I will take you to school. It's my commitment. And I said to her, 50% of the time I'll fetch you from school. So in a week, I'm guaranteed that at least 4 times out of 5, I will take her to school and we're going to have a conversation. Out of 5 days, at least 3 days, I'll be able to ask my daughter, what made you happy today? What made you sad? Who bothered you? What did you learn? So it's intentional. So it's up to you what in the hierarchy, what stands out for you. There are those who would want to say, let me chase the money so that they can live comfortably. But you're creating more problems because the values and the principles are not instilled by you, but either by a helper or your partner or your uncle or whoever. You're not there to be the one that says these are the principles and the values we must live by. But you would have paid a nanny to take care of them. You would have paid a transport or a chauffeur to take them to school. But the teachings are coming from them. So tomorrow you're going to then say, where did you learn that? When you were absent, because being a father, after love, you are a teacher. So you've allowed somebody else to come and teach your kids on how to think, how to reason, how to resolve things, how to react to life.
Like I always say, those with ears will hear. Now, what's the biggest challenge you faced when you started your entrepreneurial journey?
Two things. Money and access to the market. And I think it's still that. But probably I think I would call myself a pragmatic individual. I think earlier on you said there's no one coming to rescue us. And I think I had that from a very young age. When my mother lost her job, was retrenched, actually, she took her pension money and tried to create pockets of things that can generate us money. So one time, the milk and bones and vores business was booming. People were buying. And then another time it was off. So we didn't make money from this. She'd be having two other things. At some point we're selling beer. At some point we're selling, I don't know if you know Ibraso. Those ornaments that are goldish. At some point we sold polish. So she'll go and store polish at Dronfontein, a stoop. You know, they will come back and sell that. And its season will fade out, you know. But she was consistently looking for a stream to make money. She didn't wait for indota, because one had left her. But two, she had the little that she had from a pension fund and said, from this, this is what I'm going to do. So in the number of businesses, I can tell you now today, in the 13 years of the foundation, 70% of the time of that foundation, I have self-funded the activities of the foundation. And friends coming in and saying, I'll pay for the boys' food, the transport, or this. I still dare any government person to say, no, we funded you with 5 million rand to run the program you're running for the boys. Right now, today, I'm manufacturing school shoes. Before that, I had a transport business that was unfortunately died because of COVID. We're doing shuttle, specializing in H1s. And it took me saying I'm sacrificing driving a comfortable German car to buy the first bus, the second bus. And only at the third bus, then you're able to borrow from the bank. So it's only you who can say, I believe in this crazy idea that I have, that I'm willing to sacrifice everything else to invest in it. Many people do not want startups, whether it be government, whether it be the bank. They want to come in your booming phase and like, oh, what do you need from us? You know? So money has been a challenge. Access to market, because, for instance, we're at the phase where we've built a product, but we've been lacking. Do I have 500,000 rand to invest in marketing and publicizing my shoe business? I don't. Because of much of that money went into the production of the shoes. So my cash flow, I can't afford, I've got a cash flow, but I can't afford to say, let me take 300,000 or 500,000 and invest it in this, you know? So you must go and knock somewhere and ask them. And they'll be like, let's see. Then you come back and say, do I have a car in the garage here? Do I owe it? No. Can I sell it? Yes. How much do I get? 300,000. Okay. My hand. Because you're crazy enough to, because that's what entrepreneurship is about. Being crazy enough to believe in something, you know? So we're at a phase where we want to expand the access to market, because market is what gives you profit. Now I'm secured in understanding the product and what it can make, what is our turnaround time, and even the quality of these shoes. And I can tell you right now, you can wake me up at 2 o'clock. I compete in quality with the brand that you were wearing and I was wearing when we were going to high school and primary. So right now we're in a phase where we like want to expand the market. But expanding the market, it will take this podcast, it will take a billboard, it will take an advert on newspaper. Those are costs for us to then be able to be known and noticed by this market so that they can come and buy this product. So someone said, but you can tell people that yes, but how do I tell them? Because it's a cost to do it. So the money to start and the access to a market that must buy this product or services will always be a challenge in the life of an entrepreneur. But worst of all, I think as black people, we don't have the ability to put our money where our mouth is. And we are so unkind and so unforgiving that if we were to have a technical glitch here and this was owned by a black person, we would be so quick to say, we're not coming back here. Look at black people, you know, forgetting that everything is a trial and error. As people who are owning JSE listed companies, if not their great-grandchildren, and ask them how many times their grandfathers and grandmothers failed. But we don't have the patience for that, you know, to say, it's okay. I get people inboxing me, say, no, can you get a donation of school shoes? And I'm tempted to ask, do you know the owner of the other brand? And do you inbox them and say they must donate? Because you've got kids in your home. Where did you buy the last two pairs of those shoes? So we only know each other when it's time of need. But when I'm in need of you to support me, we don't as black people. So we would not be able to build these empires until we're able to say, let's invest in our own. Actually, Bongani might fail. But Bongani, 50,000, see which advertising space you can buy. The day you're fine, you'll pay me. If not, it's okay. Because we're in a trial and error phase, you know? So for me, I would say as black people, we need to start putting money where our mouth is. But also probably in the midst of putting our money where our mouth is, be gracious enough to forgive in errors. But also for us who are running these developing companies, is to never take for granted the clients that we have in the name of they owe you that support. Because as much as they must show up with their money, we also have a responsibility to show up with good product and services that they can say, I got the value for my money. So that's what it would take.
Wow. So this is the key mindset that we need to move an idea to a successful business.
Yeah.
Wow. And what risk or a decision that you took that changed your career journey for good?
I've only been employed once in my life for 4.5 years. And I committed myself that I will never apply for a job. And even the job I had, I was asked by somebody to say, Arman, we think you can come and do this job for us. Can you come and work for us? You know? Because immediately after I'd finished my marketing, I went to an interview. And people must not misunderstand me. Let's go to school, guys. Let's go to school.
Yeah.
But I came to this interview and the people that they took, sorry, because it was a sales, you know, rap kind of a thing. And I remember I was sitting on that passage, there were older people there. And I think it was a beverage company. And they were already told that, no, if you get employment, you get a car. I think, get a car, get an allowance. But even these products, you can give to Amachi and his preserve and so on. I'm like, hey, that'd be a good place to start. Yeah, what? But unfortunately, we were not hired. And then I asked, why were we not hired? And they said, you guys don't have experience. I said, but how do I get experience when I just graduated 2 months back?
True.
You know? And this guy said, we're running a business here. Go look for experience where you want to get experience. Here we're looking for people who are going to make us money. And for me, that immediately gave me a reminder of my mother being retrenched. And I said to myself, I don't think I want to go and beg somebody for a job. And that's why probably in my entire life, actually even now, I need to go and refine my CV because there's a board chairpersonship. They are asking for CVs. And I thought, oh, but we're all directors here. Why are we asking for CVs? Because I thought we'll get to a board meeting and be like, I, Peter must be the chairperson, you know. So I saw from the company secretary asking for nomination and asking for a CV, you know. And I was like, yo, when was the last time?
Gibberish to you, eh?
Like, yo, when was the last time I did a CV, you know? Because I'd committed myself, I'll never, including a business plan. And there are people who call me and say, hey, Bongani, a business plan, you know, how do I draft a business plan? And I'll tell you, I had one encounter that threw me off when there was still Msobomvu Youth Fund. They used to give vouchers, whether for a business plan or marketing, marketing material, none. And I remember I got this voucher to say, no, go to this company. They'll choose from these 10 companies. They are consultants. They'll help you to build a business plan. So they're taking me to an expect.
Mm.
So I'm expecting that whatever we produce out of there is something that when I get to the bank or whoever must fund, we'll read it and say, okay, the signature is 200,000 or funai. We went, did that. I gave them the things they needed, the information, gave them the quotations. And then I remember taking this to funding agencies and a bank, and they said it's not bankable.
Mm.
I said, what? I said, it's not bankable. I said, hey guys, this was done by an expect. Somebody was paid to do this thing. So they said, no, Baba, these pieces of papers, they don't mean anything for us to authorize giving you money. So from that, I said, I'm not going to go and ask somebody for money.
Wow. Wow. And what would you say is the biggest lesson that you've learned from building a business and leading people?
If you don't show up and you don't make people understand that you understand your own business, they're going to remove every two bricks you put in, they're going to remove three. Because at times we think being an entrepreneur is being a boss. Actually, they must find you in the office or find you at a construction site with a spade digging or with a whatever the thing is that we use to dig. So they have an understanding. You also have an understanding of your own business, how it works, how it fails, what would make it fail, you know? And now whenever they think of bullshitting you, they're like, ah, but Obita knows this thing.
Yeah.
But now, you know, we have this mentality that says, no, if I'm the boss, I can sleep. And like, hey, Peter, nifugile. You know? So if you're in construction, they'll steal your material. In Texas, they're going to have Himalaya Macaus. You know, because we have never went through the route. So I, when I did the logistics company, we started by providing school transport. Then we then shuttled people to send in our same servants in. Then we started having private trips. But the first Kumbi, I drove it myself. If I had to be somewhere else, I'll ask my uncle to do it for me. Got a second Kumbi, got a third Kumbi. So now I had people coming in. Then I end up surrendering the first Kumbi, three drivers. And because I used the corporate mentality and not the taxi mentality, I gave them so much money in allowances. Allowance for ngalale kaya, sleeping in Tuyando, you know, 50 rands for breakfast, 50 rands for lunch, you know. Till one time, this guy, I said, I'm a good driver, he owns taxis. And the guy came back complaining, Damlung, you're not paying us. You know, is giving us money takes, money gula, is giving us money a phone and giving us money for not sleeping at home. Because when I got into that formal job, we've been paid a pedium for not being at home. You know, then this guy says, "Me chief smoshela bantu." But also when I was making the calculations, I'm like, "Bongani, we are losing money here." So by the time I wanted to remove all of those things, the guys were saying, "No, see a protester. You know, we're not going to do this thing," and so on. I said, no, it's okay. So what do you want to stick to? Flat salary. You guys take shuttle people to, so I had shuttles to Sentin and shuttle to Centurion. So then I said to them, it's fine. You guys do the daily work. Take people to work, come back, drop them off, leave my buses. Yeah? So any special trip that came, I said, no, it's fine. I'll do it myself. And they thought I was joking. So I'll come back, park my car. I tell them, Mangeta, Fagimoto, a car wash. I'll come and pick it up myself and then do the special run. If it's for Friday night or it's for Saturday and so on, I'll come and do it. And I think I did that for almost 2 months. Then they realized the little extra that this man was paying us outside of these allowances was making a difference in our pocket. And they come back and say, ah, man, Mlungu, man, yes. Hey, man, I said, no, but I told you guys, I'm giving you 150 for food. You don't buy food. The people you are transporting, when you stop at the garage, they buy you things. They ask you, do you want something to drink? But they actually cook, but they actually amounts, you know? So I'm like, I am aware of those things. And you guys, and so if I had not taken time to do this myself, I wouldn't have known where I'm, you know, letting money go loose and what is it that they are benefiting out of me that I could actually close on. So once people know and understand that you are hands on, they will not take you for.
You know what I like about this conversation, and especially with the people that are sat down with and I spoke with them, it validates that success literally, it's one principle. It's the same principle for success. And what you're literally saying here is what other previous thought leaders also said. You need to be involved. And not everyone is going to believe in your vision. Some people will try to take advantage of you, but you need to be involved.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, for a young kid that's watching and they want to also start their own ventures, what advice would you give them?
Go to school. Be disciplined. It's only through hard work that you can succeed.
Wow.
But also take time to learn from other people's journey. So that you can try and not have the same mistake. But the best teacher is experience. But you don't have to experience every fumble for you to understand that's a fumble. But you can have a conversation with Peter and be like, Peter, you have done 1, 2, 3. How do I not make the same mistakes that you have made? You know? And never show up in life as somebody that knows it all. And whether from big people or small people, there's always a lesson you can learn. You know? So don't wait for those who've got titles and suits and think that they are the ones who've got answers for your problems. Half the time, those who are successful, especially black people, don't want to share. Because we live in that space of being the first. I don't know if you have seen any Afrikaners or English people saying, I'm the first, what. But with us, black people, it's such a glorious thing. I'm the first one to matriculate in the family. I'm the first one to have graduated at university. I'm the first one, the first vice chancellor is a woman, the first black accountant, the first town planning PhD hold. We've got this obsession of being the first and probably being remembered as the first of that. That we forget that the more they are in the pool, the more we can contribute to the body of work in that sector. You know? And the mistake then we do is to admire those who are there. Many of the people we refer to as amakhotmane, those who've made it, whether in business, whether in politics, almost all of them, their hands are empty because they're not carrying anyone's hands. So as a young boy and a young girl, don't think that somebody's waiting to hold your hand. Actually, they're the ones that might cut those fingers. So you can't only respect those who have made it and say, I want to be mentored by Peter. There's a hot man in Lukshin who's continuously been fixing kettles. Kelel. Anyone says, Mpugelwe kelel, but Iyakumalum ka Peter. And you know, you might look at them like, there's nothing to learn there. But ask them how they've consistently been fixing. And they'll tell you by just plugging this thing, where's the problem? Those who are more successful than us, almost all of them, majority of them, they are not going to create a room for us to sit on the same table as them. So don't think that as growing up, you're looking up to these people and think they're the ones that are going to hold your hand. They're not. They're not. And that's why I do not like the idea of I'm a hot man and the first this and first that. I'm a hot man, they're not going to. I'm still waiting for somebody who's going to say part of the top 10 millionaires, this hot man actually opened the door for me. But I can show you a couple of people who have been helped by white millionaires, including the very same hot man that we hold so dear, that even themselves, they were helped by some of these white people. Am I glorifying white people? No. But I'm saying amongst ourselves, those we regard as a hot man, a sister, they are not there to hold others and bring them into the space and say, let's have more millionaires, let's have more PhD holders, let's have more professors. How many people cite each other on academic papers. Ask those who are doing PhD and masters. Very few, many of them actually go and cite Harvard scholars, University of Columbia, and so on. No one says no. Doctors Banban was at University of Johannesburg or Setswana University of Technology once said. That's, we can look at dissertations in the past year and let's check how many of those have actually referenced a South African academic. So we're our own enemies.
Wow. That's powerful. That's really powerful. Now, I know we've spoken vastly about the issue of mental health, of which I know that you are a strong voice for that. But I want to know from you, as a business owner, as a leader, what has running a business and leading people demanded from you mentally and emotionally?
It demands your all. And it comes with a lot of sacrifice. And many employees don't know that half the time, if not most of the time, when they get paid, they're not paid. And being an entrepreneur, you've got to have that awakening of you chose to be an entrepreneur, which means part of the first principles is to put others first, those who are working for you. So that is going to hurt you mentally because the books are not going to balance. But before you think of your debts, you must think about their debts. And after you've thought about their debts, you coming back home, either your parents are going to tell you you're useless because you didn't come back with anything. If you are married or you've got a stable partner, they're going to tell you how useless you are because you're not able to bring anything. And you said you're an entrepreneur. And whenever you are a leader or an entrepreneur, people think that you live in the world of plenty. So money, yavuza, power gives you access to everything. But they don't understand that it comes with sacrificing yourself first and putting others. So you're the last one. The same thing that our parents do, okay, except for parents of these days, they want to eat first. It's cool where parents eat, we eat first and then they eat after. You know, that's what it requires. Being a leader and being an entrepreneur, that's what it requires, that you put others first. Once they've eaten and there are crumbs or there's nothing on the table, you pretend as if you've eaten. And you share the same smile as they share. But deep down your head, because your stomach is empty. So that is going to mess up you mentally and emotionally. Because also not only are your employees, but your peers and your family members, because you said you are an entrepreneur, they think you've got this big pocket in my pay money. So they'll always ask, hey, Mchana, how do uncle 200 lap? You know? And as and when you're not able to provide, or you can't put yourself in the shoes of saying, no, I don't have, it messes with your mental space. And many of us take too long to realize that actually you've got to operate on I don't have and no, even when you have it. So you are going to be tested. That's why somehow, some of these entrepreneurs, you end up, and even leaders as well, they end up developing some addiction as an escape outlet because you don't want to deal with what you're suffering from, your inability to say no, your inability to accept that your circumstances don't allow you to do certain things. So you find an escape route. So they're going to be sex addict, a drug addict, alcohol addict, or you're going to be a pathological liar that continues to borrow money from everyone and anyone. Like, ah, man, the invoice, I'm going to pay the money. And probably this one, you're borrowing this money to feed any of these other addictions because that's your escape. So you're not even taking this money to go and pay for a therapist or a coach because not all of us or every time do we need a therapy. Sometimes you need a coach who can coach you to say, this is how you can build on this business that you want. This is how you can build on this podcast and having followers and having to monetize this. Somebody can coach you and say, actually, this is how you can navigate building this union that you have with this woman. You know, sometimes you just need a coach who can tell you, can coach you on how best to be a father or a husband or yourself. You know, because at times we think, Living in your own mind and in your emotions only takes therapy. Sometimes it just needs a coach and a mentor, somebody that you're accountable to, you check in with. I've got three mentors in different spheres. One of them, I said to them, says, no, but why does Mang Mang to be your mentor? I said, no, but when you're not a businessman, you've got so much grace that I might end up not making profit, but selling these things, you know, because you are that gracious person who always wants to be. So she's a community builder. So whatever we would be making as profit, she would want us to spend it back in the community. So I said to her, I can't come and ask for business advice, you know, but there's advice that I'm looking at. How do I become a better human being? How do I contribute to society? But for me to be a shrewd businessman, I must go and find a mentor that is a businessman so that they teach me how to be shrewd and make this profit. Then I come back and talk to you and we say, how do we put this money to good use? You know, so you've got to be able to segment and say, what am I looking for? So it's not every time where you need a therapist. It's not every time where you need a coach. It's not every time where you need a mentor, you know, and you interact and interface with these people at different times in different circumstances. A mentor, you can see them once in 3 months or once or twice a year, you know. A coach, because you've got an end goal, you could see them every month or whenever you think you must make a decision. A therapist could be that you need to make sense of whatever that is continuously and perpetually bothering you. So in showing up as your best self. So you then go to that room so that you can reflect and have a conversation and they poke your thoughts. So you must be able to then distinguish what is it that you need at that particular time. A mentor is someone that you can have continuously because you don't meet each other every day.
True.
A therapist would move and can move from every week because, or every second day because you've got this big thing that you need to offload and make an understanding and make decisions and get over it. But then you still need to live in the room because you've got to continuously be saying, let me keep my thoughts in check. Let me keep a conversation going on how I've dealt with Upita. I could live here and call my therapist or coach and like, as Upita asked me this question, was I wrong to find it problematic or intimidating? Was I overreacting when I thought he's being unreasonable by asking me that question? So you're going to a coaching session just to reflect on something that you think could make you lose who you are at that particular time. And just a 5-10 minutes conversation, and they say, no, we don't think you were unreasonable. Actually, he was wrong. Or actually, you were overreacting. Look at it like this. Probably they were sitting on the other side of the table and looking at things, the chessboard from the other side. Then you're like, oh yeah, I could have fumbled and reacted badly, but I restrained myself, because you're continuously in check of how you reason and how you react to things. So it's quite important to have that set, a therapist, a coach, and a mentor, because you'll use them at different times.
Wow, that's well said. And the reason why I'm asking this is that I took it upon myself to say, you know, I want people to see that even the people that we look up to, successful people, business people, they also go through some things that we don't see behind the curtain. And that was well said. Now, before I let you go here.
yes, please.
we have a tradition here, right? So every guest that comes into the show, you can see this shiny ball. Surely you are asking yourself, what the hell is this? This is our legacy there.
Okay.
You know, so every guest that comes into the show leaves behind a legacy note. And this could be anything that you want the future generation, future leaders, future business people, entrepreneurs to know. So these are words from Ubongani, Se Bongani Luval, you know, to the future generation. So I did ask you before the show, so whenever you're ready, you can throw that note into the box.
I mustn't say it?
No.
Okay.
There we go. Now, This for me, I deem it as a very, very special moment, because your words and this conversation will live beyond this episode. And for me, I think that's what legacy or legacies are made of.
Sure.
So thank you so much. Now, one last thing. I promise after this, I let you go.
Sure.
I have a quick game that I want to play with you, right?
Okay.
So the rule of this game is you don't have to think much. You just give me the answer.
Okay.
Right? Are you ready?
Sure.
So love or legacy? Choose one.
Legacy.
Legacy. Fatherhood in one word.
Selfless.
What's one thing people always get wrong about you after watching Married at First Sight?
I've not had an opportunity. it's only my perception. But generally, I think people see me as a good guy.
Mm.
But also, they don't know my thoughts. I think everyone's been crying to hear my thoughts. So, yeah. I think generally everyone keeps on saying, he's a good guy. And I think it comes from a pity place. Like, no, she's a good guy. Yeah.
If you could sit down with any leader, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
Sure. Does it have to be a leader?
Okay, anyone that's impactful to you.
My grandmother.
Grandmother, ah, that's sweet.
She passed on when I was, I think, in grade 3. But I can still remember our conversations.
If you lost everything today, what's that one mindset or skill that will help you rebuild everything back?
My integrity.
Wow. Well said. Integrity. Thank you so much for joining me on the show. This was a very, very powerful conversation that we had. Very emotional, very insightful. So thank you so much for that. I really appreciate. And once again, congratulations on the new book. And to you, our audience, thank you so much for tuning in. If there's anything that resonated with you in this powerful conversation with Bongani, please do like, share, comment. Don't forget to subscribe and get yourself a copy.
Yes.
I will be getting one myself. And till I see you next time on the next episode, this is Success Unscripted with Peter Manjad. Thank you. Bob.
Thank you.
Yeah, boom.
Thank you very much.
This was a powerful conversation.
Sure.